like to tee up for us?
Today we're going to finish up with the overview with the State Court Administrator's Office, which we postponed from Wednesday of last week, and then move into performance measures.
Okay. Great. Let's click. Sorry.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, and with me is Sarah Gates, the Deputy State Court Administrator. We're going to finish up, as Ms. Lamont said, the overview from last Wednesday having to do with the major components of the Judicial Department's budget. This last component will look at the administration, central charges, and mandated payments. And that's starting with page 30 of your overview document. Because we're here and this stuff is fairly high level, we'll move through it quickly so that we can get to your meat and potatoes issues with performance measures and some of the projects that the department's working on that'll be discussed during the performance measures. On page 30, you'll see that administration and central costs are approximately 20% of our budget. The Office of the State Court Administrator is a statutory, well, actually the State Court Administrator position is a statutory position. Its main purpose is to support the Chief Justice in carrying out his administrative authority and leadership responsibilities under the statute. The Chief Justice, as you heard speak on Wednesday, not only is the presiding judge of the Oregon Supreme Court, he is also the main head of the judicial branch of government. And in that capacity, we have probably four, I would characterize it as four subcategories of what the Office of the State Court Administrator does. I mean, one, we provide the administrative infrastructure for the Judicial Department vis-a-vis our external customers. That we prepare the budget, we work with the legislative program, we do grants, contracting, all sorts of things on behalf of the Judicial Department itself. We also are responsible for the infrastructure services for the department in the areas of procurement, budget, accounting, personnel systems, legal systems, audit services, risk management, education, court programs, analytical services, pro tem services, and information technology. And all these you're going to hear about as we go through the next few days in other capacities. Our office is also the central administrative office for the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. So we're the clerk's office for that and have functions for the appellate and tax court in that regard. Then we also have some program areas that by statute that have been assigned to us, and those have to do with certification of interpreters, shorthand reporters, and the running the Citizen Review Board program, which you'll hear a little bit more about later. On page 32 is just kind of a capsulization of the Office of the State Court Administrator. There's six basic divisions. The seventh one is really our central management services, but they give a little bit more information about the sorts of program areas and responsibilities and duties that we carry out on behalf of the Judicial Department. I want to emphasize, and we'll probably come back to that in some other capacities, there's roughly 200 people performing the functions here. I did bring a handout that shows how many people are in each of the divisional areas, should you want to see that. But basically, for instance, in our personnel division, we have 12 FTE. We have 5 human resource managers, and so those human resource managers serve all 2,000 people in the courts. So roughly 400 people, staff and judges, per human resource manager. So I wanted to kind of illustrate that our office does not perform services that are not duplicated in the trial courts. We are the human resource office for the entire court system. We are the legal contracting system for the whole court system. We are the IT shop for the whole court system, though you will learn there are some ancillary IT positions in the trial courts. So on page 33 is a little more of a breakdown of how the money in our office is broken out by these core functions. We do have more information that will probably come up during our budget discussions about what these percentages are: general fund, other fund, and federal funds. For the most part, 75% is general funded and 25% is other funded or federal funded. On pages 34 and 35 are just some of the continuous improvement projects that related mainly to technology that we've been involved with in this biennium. We do, with the performance measures, if those of you have been on our committee before, maybe only Representative Hannah and Robin will remember, we have a train that comes later that talks about how our Judicial Department mission, vision, performance measures are all part of a continuum, and our continuous improvement programs and our strategic planning every biennium is off our performance measures and our overall vision and goals. So we tie it all together that we're going in a direction, a clear direction for our priorities and for our expenditures. I'm going to let Sarah Gates, so you have a little bit different voice for a few minutes, talk through our financial and business aspects, primarily the revenue and then our mandated services out of our budget.
For the record, I'm Sarah Gates, the Deputy State Court Administrator for Business, and I probably need to pull the mic over so you can hear me. I'm going to start on page 36, and you do have a couple of replacement pages that should be in front of you for pages 37 through 40, so that the numbers I actually talk to you about will make sense. You might want to grab those. Basically, I'm going to take just a few minutes to talk about how much money we collect and where it goes. For the upcoming biennium, we are forecasted to collect $256.8 million plus another $24 million in restitution. The $256 million is predominantly distributed to three places: the general fund, the criminal fines and assessment account, which you had a briefing on back in January, and to state and local governments. And those state governments do include the Oregon Judicial Department for collections purposes. Page 37 that you just replaced has a pie chart that shows you how that money breaks out. The pie chart does not include restitution. That obviously goes to victims. The next page, page 38, shows the historical growth in the amount of revenue that we collect in the OJD. And you can see that we've had strong growth over the last, you know, 7 or 8 biennia, and we're projected to continue to grow. That's due to many different things: changes in fees and assessments, general growth in the size of the state, improved collections. And you're going to hear a lot more about our collections program, so I'm not going to focus on it right now. You're going to be hearing about that in the performance measures in just a few minutes. We do get some other sources of revenue. We've heard about other funds and federal funds. It's a very small part of the revenue we collect. Page 39 shows you a breakout of that. And that's predominantly transfers in for programs as well as sales of publications and for usage on the Oregon Judicial Information Network. It's called OJIN Online. It's for public access to our data. The next thing I want to talk to you about is the mandated payments piece of our budget. That's on page 40. Mandated payments is a category that we use for payments for the cost of running juries, as well as interpreters in the courts and ADA accommodation. There are two major components, the first of which is discussed on page 41. That's the jury payments. That's the cost of identifying and paying for the jurors that sit in the trial court juries as well as the grand jury. We do pay a small amount for ADA compliance. The place I want to spend a little bit of time explaining to you is what is shown on pages 42 and 43, which is for interpreters. That's an area that we have had very strong growth in expenditures, and in fact, we received a supplemental appropriation for the current biennium. If you'll focus on the chart on page 43, I'll explain to you. You can see the growth that we've recently gone through. The dotted line in the middle of the chart shows the appropriation that we faced we were given at the beginning of this biennium. We had a supplemental appropriation request of $1.7 million. And as you can see from the chart, we've had really, really strong growth in both the Spanish languages and in the non-Spanish languages, the white bar being the Spanish. The medium gray is non-Spanish, and that includes 90 languages that we interpret for in the courts. The top bar shows the cost of the staff we have in OJD to provide interpretation. There are 19.5 staff that are used to schedule and provide in-court interpretation. Now, the thing we'll be discussing later on, probably tomorrow, in fact, as we talk about our central budget level, is how much money do we need to provide for this service next biennium. And as you can see from the dark line on there, demand is anticipated to exceed what we requested when we put in the Chief Justice's recommended budget. And we'll talk more about how much we are projecting our need to be tomorrow, but needless to say, the growth for interpreters is very, very strong, and this is an area that's been growing in our budget over time. On the last page of this section, it talks about how we've...
Just a moment, sir.
Yes.
Senator Brown.
Two quick questions. On the mandated payments, I'm curious on the jury payments. I'm assuming that the counties schedule their jurors and determine days and all that kind of stuff, and it's done on a county-by-county basis.
It's done on a, Senator Brown, Representative Shields, it's done on a circuit court by circuit court basis.
Okay, all right. But you don't control, Mr. Chair, follow up, you don't control how long the jurors stay and whether they're being efficiently used and all that kind of stuff, right?
Representative Shields, Senator Brown, that's something that's determined at the circuit court level, and Kingsley may have more experience that she can add to this.
All right, Mr. Chair. Moving to the interpreter, I know that the state of Washington won an award for how they use interpreters, and I'm pretty sure it was the court system, but it may have been through DHS, and I didn't know if you'd examined state of Washington and what they're doing with court interpreting systems at all, or any other. Have you looked at any other state in terms of providing interpreting services?
Representative Shields, Senator Brown, I personally don't have, I do not work in that program, so I can't answer that, but
okay.
I can find out and I'll get back to you on
That'd be great. Thanks.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown. Yes, Washington and Oregon were one of five states that were in the initial consortium that set up the court certification and testing program through the National Center. So they actually had the first program, and we went along with New Jersey, and we went to them and then followed up and put together the national program, and we do still work with them.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you. You had referred us to look at the dotted line in the charts on page 43, and I wanted to ask a question to make a comment about that, and recognizing that my nameplate got knocked over, and it's a difficult name anyway, if you would just want to call me Representative, that's fine. I've been looking at lots of charts for a long time, but if I'm looking at this one correctly, is there some sort of fixed number for Spanish and non-Spanish, and then a number of dollars on top of a number of incidents, or what is this?
Representative Shields, Representative Nathanson, what you're seeing is the dollar costs for each of those components. So what you're seeing is in the white bar, that's how much money in millions it costs us each year to provide Spanish interpretation in the courts. The next level is how much it costs each year to provide for the other approximately 90 languages that we interpret. And finally, the top is how much it costs for the staff interpreters and the schedulers that work for the department. And those are about 19 positions.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, to add to that, we have a combination of private and employees. We have employees who are centralized with the Spanish who provide daily interpretation, then we also have contract services in the sense of we pay them hourly or half day or daily to appear both in Spanish and then in the other lesser used languages. And we have a staff person also for the deaf and hearing impaired.
Follow up? So the the first two stacks, white and gray in color, mm-hmm. are for contract labor.
Representative Shields, Representative Nathan, that's correct.
Thank you. It just wasn't on here.
Oh,
so
thanks. Good clarification. Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you.
Chair Shields, that makes me ask a question then. If the first two are for contracted services for Spanish and non-Spanish, and the top box is for staff services, is it staff services across both of the other Spanish and non-Spanish?
Representative Shields, Representative Hannah, they speak the staff interpreters are in languages other Spanish as well as others, as well as the schedulers. Does that answer what you're trying to get at?
Can I follow up? So if you took the bottom white box that's Spanish,
mm-hmm.
you'd add to that some of the cost in the top box as well for Spanish, because some of the staff folks would be doing Spanish interpretation.
Representative Shields, Representative Hannah, that is absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Please continue.
I can finish up in just a second. On page 44, I just wanted to point out some of the ways we're trying to control the costs, because this is an area that is growing very, very rapidly due to the changes in the demographics of our state. So we've been moving to centralized scheduling of these independent interpreters to make sure that we're using those resources as efficiently as possible. And we're also using video conferencing to do interpretation to minimize the travel time to the more remote areas, especially when you're dealing with a more esoteric language that's not spoken on a common basis. Any other questions? Thank you.
Chair Shields would like to move to the performance measure piece of our presentation today, and Judge Brewer from the Court of Appeals and Jim Adams from the trial court from Jackson County will be up here speaking about that item.
Welcome back to the committee, Your Honor. Whenever you're ready.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, it's nice to be back and see you again today. I'm Dave Brewer, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and with me today are Jim Adams, the Trial Court Administrator of Jackson County, who's one of the state's leaders in performance measurement, and also from our Court Program Services Division, Leola McKenzie, who's also an expert in this area. I'm going to start out, if it's okay with you, by giving you a brief overview of the Judicial Branch's Performance Measures Program. These materials are included starting at page 45 of your materials. As you've heard us say repeatedly, the trial courts are the cornerstone of judicial branch operations. And one of the most important assessment tools that a trial court system can have is a meaningful performance measurement protocol. Performance measurement serves two critical functions in any healthy court system. First, it allows us to demonstrate to our external constituents, that is you, our legislative colleagues, and the public, how well our enterprise is carrying out its mission in the use of public funds. Within that framework, courts can explain how the legitimate resource needs they're required to carry out their mission either are or are not sufficient to do their work. Second, and equally important, performance measurement, when coupled with a sound case management system, provides valuable internal information that enables our courts to get the best outcomes from the resources at their disposal. Among other things, performance measurement allows courts to locate efficiency drains. It helps us allocate scarce resources more productively, and it helps identify and implement best practice solutions more strategically. Very little of this work has been done in the United States at the appellate level. However, Oregon is taking the national lead in performance measurement initiatives for its appellate courts. And I'll just give you a little bit of history to explain how that came about. When I became Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals in late 2004, the budget elements already had been prepared for our court for the 05-07 biennium. And I noticed that some information about our court's previous year's case clearance rate had been included in our budget profile. Now, as you may know, a clearance rate is the ratio of new filings, new case filings, to completed cases in a given time period. The information provided was given without explanation or context, though, and in short, it told the legislature nothing meaningful about what really was going on with the Court of Appeals caseload. At that point, we got interested in providing better information, and with the support of Chief Justice DeMunis in 2005, the Court of Appeals embarked on a purposeful performance measurement development process. That process has led to the adoption of four tentative performance measures for the Court of Appeals that are summarized at page 61 of your materials. And I'll elaborate on those measures in a few minutes, but I want to make two key points before turning the presentation over to Jim Adams. The first is that we believe firmly that what gets measured gets done. By stating organizational goals and developing a way to measure our progress in achieving those goals, we commit ourselves to maximizing the outcomes of our work. The second point is that every healthy organization has to be willing to discuss and evaluate its shortcomings, not merely trumpet its perceived strengths. By doing that, we both improve our credibility and we arrive at better solutions to entrenched problems that may have multiple and complex causes. In my view, those two points are the true bottom line of a performance measure initiative. And with that preface, I'm going to ask Jim Adams, who is one of the leaders of the Performance Measures Committee at the trial court level, to give us the trial court report to be followed by some follow-up with Leola. So, Jim, please.
Chair, committee members, thank you. I want to say on behalf of the Performance Measures Advisory Committee that I chair, as well as Judge Brewer mentioned, I'm the court administrator in Jackson County, but I want to say thank you for this opportunity for us to be here and be representative and share the committee's work with you. If I leave you with one thought, I hope it is that the OJD is truly, truly committed to performance measures. As the Judge Brewer just mentioned, you know, we have found them to be the best vehicle that we can come up with.
Thank you. To improve both the quality as well as the efficiency of our justice system. But secondly, at the core, is it allows us to more effectively respond to public demands for accountability, to be able to show and to demonstrate what we do with the valuable resources that we're entrusted with. Judge just mentioned a number of areas. I'd like to add just a couple thoughts to that, is that they really truly sharpen our focus as a department, as a branch of government, on what is in terms of is truly important. They have provided consistency of our services, important management controls, and as Judge Brewer said, they foster direction towards best practices. On page 48 of your handouts, there's a kind of a history. I'm not really going to spend much time on it for the sake of trying to use this time wisely, only to mention that in 2004, former Chief Justice Carson created the Performance Measures Advisory Committee. We refer to it as PMAC. The legislature in 2005 adopted 10 revised performance measures that we recommended to you. And in 2006, the circuit courts and OSCA divisions developed implementation plans to both support our strategic plan, the Justice 2020 vision of the Oregon court system, as well as performance measures. They are deeply embedded in our budgeting and planning processes. And finally, as Judge Brewer said, the Court of Appeals has begun the important work in partnership with a number of national programs to try to create or to work on the first set of performance measures for appellate courts in the United States. On page 49, we'll begin the performance measures, and then at the conclusion of the 10, we'll come back, or I'll take a break at some point and turn it over to Judge Brewer. The first performance measure is accessible interpreter services, and we actually measure that by the percent of spoken language interpreter services expenditures by Oregon certified interpreters. The purpose of this, I hope is clear, is to ensure access to all people to the courts and the justice process. That for non-English speaking persons, interpreter services are essential for them to be able to participate in their own proceedings. Certification of interpreters is our best method to ensure both the quality of court interpreting services that, and as well as compliance with federal legal mandates. And the Oregon's certification process is limited to three languages. Good morning. Spanish, Russian, as well as Vietnamese. During 2006, the OJD provided interpreter services in Oregon courts in more than 90 different languages. A bit of trending, we've gone from 2001 at 68% certified interpreter services, providing services in the courts, to 85% in 2007. For this next biennium, it's the recommendation of PMAC that we respectfully request this body to retain our current measure but allow us to increase the target to 95%. We do this both as a means of trying to remain aspirational, as well as Kingsley Click, our state court administrator, said, we think we still have rooms for improved efficiencies by centralization of interpreter and translator systems. Ultimately, too, there's a pop that we'll probably hear of tomorrow in the policy option package wherein there'll be a rate increase request for freelance certified interpreters. On page 50 through 52, and I'll probably give my longest explanation of this measure because it drew so much interest in the 2005 session, is our collections measure. And that is simply defined as the amount of money that's total collected divided by the total amounts of money that are ordered by the court. That dates back to 1987. When we constructed our performance measures, we did those in alignment with our strategic plan, our long-term vision. There are five elements of that. The first is access to justice. The second is the effective administration of the courts. Thirdly, is quality dispute resolution services. Fourth is community partnerships. And last but not least is public trust and confidence. Our goal is to have a minimum of one performance measure representing each of those five general thematic areas within our long-term strategic plan. In terms of our collections rate, it's imperative that the enforcement of monetary amounts that are imposed by the courts are collected because they hold the people that are before the court accountable for their action, as well as we can never restore victims whole, but we can certainly make every effort to try to restore them financially. Consequently, the Chief Justice's policy is that within the department, every Oregon court is responsible to make every possible effort to collect our receivables. The Oregon trial court standards are substantial in terms of what we do internally. As a minimum, every trial court is measured on how quickly and accurately we're able to create accounts receivables and establish account balances, enter them into our computer systems. Delinquent accounts usually go about 30 days or so before we actually send an automated notice out. If it goes another 30 days or so, it's usual and customary, if it's a traffic-related offense, we'll actually move to license suspension. We'll give that 30 to 60 more days. We'll move on to orders to appear, warrants for arrest, et cetera, or work with probation and parole offices. Still no activity. We'll refer the case to the Department of Revenue Collections, where it typically can set for up to a year while they work on a variety of techniques to try to make collections on the outstanding receivables, including retrieval of monies from any state income tax returns that might become available. When that case is referred back to us, this is all through automation, we'll then move the case to a private third-party collection company who will use all the standard processes available to third-party collections. This company, Ally, tends to specialize in court collections, really difficult, hard-to-collect types of cases. They'll work that case anywhere from 9 months to 2 years. They have the ability to do things like to garnish wages, et cetera. And finally, if it comes back in my court, we'll turn around and refer it back to DOR for a second chance if, in fact, the amount owing is over $500. As Kingsley said, the projected collections for 2005-2007 for the Oregon Judicial Department will exceed $256 million. I'm very proud to say that every year since 2000, the OJD's collections rate, the percentage, as well as the dollar figures have increased, and that's directly related because of our commitment to collections. In 2006, we were able to, the first time, create a workaround. We really have a challenge when it comes to performance measures that our OGIN computer system, our case management, our financial systems are very outdated, and we have to do a lot of workarounds in order to try to create meaningful and effective administrative reports. But for the first time, we were able to actually calculate where our receivables are at. And in fact, the PMAC committee hasn't even had this information to work with yet. More than 91% of our outstanding receivables are criminally related, directly linked to criminal cases. Of that, 54% are felony, 37% misdemeanor, and a very significant number of those misdemeanor cases are directly tied to felony cases. We're doing a pilot program right now, and we're averaging almost 4 outstanding court receivables for each felon case that exists. Quickly summarizing the trending from 2000, we had a 50% collections rate. To 2007, I'm pleased to report that you can actually make a slight modification in your data that you have before you on that our collections rate is now at 65%. For the 2007-2009 biennium, we respectfully recommend the retention of the current measure as well as the target. We recognize that I'll probably be sitting here before you in 2009 reporting that we didn't achieve that target again. But nonetheless, we still feel we really need, because for if nothing less than for the sake of victims, to continue to stretch trial courts and make every improvement and every effort imaginable and possible for those monies. In 2007-2009, I am pleased to report we have a number of court improvement projects going on our trial court performance measures, and one of them is this very measure. I believe now we have 23 of 37 courts are able to comply with the 68% target. OSCA is now working with 3 pilot courts, minus one, in Oregon to try to increase courts that have lower collections rates and get them up within the targets. My court has one of the highest accuracy and timely entry, as well as efforts made at the trial court level. But one of the issues is when you have the vast majority of your outstanding receivables or felons, that also is a community issue. It becomes a community issue because they're on probation. These fines are typically imposed as a condition of probation parole, and that's a lot of times the jurisdiction of both the community justice department, the probation parole officer, as well as the district attorney's office, as well as the courts, DAs, and others. These are really a community issue as well. And in these courts, our collections people in OSCA are actually creating workarounds to generate monthly status reports to probation parole officers on the payment status on a monthly basis, almost real time, for where their probation parolees are at.
Mr. Adams?
Yes, sir.
For people who are under supervision, do the probation and parole officers actually collect the fees and or does that go through the courts?
Chair Shields, that's an excellent question. The actual collections of the money occur through the court. Probation parole's job as a condition of probation parole is to monitor the payments, and in the failure to do so, notify the court through what's called a motion order to show cause or a probation violation for noncompliance with the conditions of probation. That's kind of, I believe Co-Chair Schrader coined the phrase systems measures, and this is a classic example of a system measure where we're not operating in a vacuum, but we actually have to work in partnership with the community justice folks, and that's what we're attempting to do in these pilot projects. You have my word, we'll be back in 2009 and report our work. Our preliminary efforts look very promising. We hope to be able to expand this project through a policy option package you'll probably hear about tomorrow, as well as whatever we learn out of this process, we will definitely share statewide in terms of best practices. On page 53, you'll find performance measure number 3. Performance measure 3 is OGIN data entry and accuracy. Because the official court record is the electronic record, OGIN, it's imperative that we enter information in a timely way and accurate. The way we actually measure this is the average number of days between when a document comes in and is file stamped and when it's actually entered into the computer system as a starting event. I believe if you look at the trending, it's been very positive. We moved from 2003, an average of 3.59 days, to in 2007 down to 0.74 days. with the target being at 0.9. The reason quality data is so important is that all facets of the criminal justice system are dependent upon it, including public safety, the conduct of business, domestic relations, child safety, juvenile law, and a whole host of other types of cases.
Yes, excuse me real quick. You just mentioned some statistics over time, and I'm not sure I have those on my sheet. Could you repeat that?
From 2002, it took an average of 3.59 days from the date of receipt when a document was file stamped to the date of the starting event was entered into our computer system, the case management system we refer to as OGIN. In 2000, and incrementally, we've improved that to 0.74 days. The standard was 9.
So it's moved down to 0.74 days, yes, but the new measure in 2007 will be 3 days? So.
Yes, and the reason for that is we'd like to change the measure. We'd like to change it to from the front end of receiving a data entry to the back end, from the time a judge signs a judgment to the time it's entered into the official court record, for several reasons. The primary reason we'd like to ask your permission to modify that to that measure is that, candidly, a monetary obligation remains not enforceable until it's entered into the court record, OGIN. So that just simply to have a judge sign off on a judgment, if we don't get that entered into OGIN in a timely way, it's not an enforceable action. That hinders victim restitution, that hinders business and the ability to capture their monies, et cetera. Secondly, we hope to be moving towards an automated court record system, which would mean electronic filings, which would mean scanning documents upon receipt, and that would artificially lower this standard. Thirdly, we feel like we've done an awful lot on this, and the low-lying fruit has been picked. We're at a point where we're satisfied with our performance, and we'd like to challenge ourselves to the next level up. That's the purpose for the requested modification of PM3.
And a question that perhaps might have been more relevant to your previous testimony is there are a lot of companies that are scanning the public records to find out, you know, everything from criminal records of potential employees to divorce to credit history, et cetera. Do those type of companies pay a fee, or is that free to them, just like it would be if I walked in and tried to find the information?
Chair Shields, and certainly I'd like to defer to the people from OSCA that control that kind of process, but my understanding is that if a member from the public comes in and asks to review a file, a public document, it's public. Obviously, they're welcome to do so, and we would gladly provide that. What you're talking about most probably is access to OGIN, and there's a fee for that, as well as there are fees attached to actual costs for any kinds of data runs that we're required to create to provide that kind of information.
So a company that does background checks, criminal background checks, and uses OGIN would pay how much? Any idea?
Representative Shields, I'm not sure how much they pay.
We could certainly find that out for you.
Could you get the information around?
You need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Representative Shields, members of the committee, my name is Leola McKenzie. I'm the Acting Director for Court Programs and Services.
Thanks. And the reason I mention it is because it's big business, and they should be paying their fair share. That's what I thought. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to back up and ask a question about revenue collections before we move to measure number 4. Are we about there?
You mean, well, we've already hit revenue collections. You want to go backwards?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, one page, please.
That's fine.
Thank you. I have two questions from page 52. One of the first points there is automatically referring debt to private collection firms and Department of Revenue. The first question is, what is the experience of success for the same kind of collection from private collection firms versus collecting via department staff, state agency staff? And if there's a difference, what might account for the difference? The second question is on the federal tax return lottery offset about the ability to intercept lottery winnings in excess of $600. I wondered how that number was arrived at.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I can answer the first question. The first question is what is the percent breakdown, as I understood the question, of receivables that are collected by the court? The court collects a little more than 80 cents on every dollar that's collected. The Department of Revenue, approximately 14 cents, and the private collections company, Allied, approximately 6 cents. Allied's challenge is a little more difficult. By the time they get that case, it's been really worked over well. But the breakdown is basically about 80, 16, and 6%. 80, 14, and 6%. On your second question, do you have a few?
I do. Okay. Representative Nathanson, Representative Shields, the $600 was derived from, that's the amount that when a person wins a lottery game, that they can get up to $600 from the local retailer, and they need to collect winnings over $600 from the lottery office.
Senator Winters?
Well, first I need to explain that.
Senator Winters'
I was surprised
birthday.
With the birthday celebration today in the Galleria, and the Red Hat ladies presented me with the Red Hat today. So, anyway, but I just want to comment on the collections as the one of the major sponsors of legislation that began that required that we aggressively collect fines and penalty. I just want to say commend you on the increase in percentages over time and the work that you're doing. And the private sector collection that was added on several bills several sessions ago was in recognition that that they would not be able to actually have the same percentage rate because by the time they receive the accounts, they're very, very old. And but it was recognized that even though they were old, that they sometimes have tools and investigative work that we don't have and are able to then to collect some of those dollars. So I sometimes I think it probably if we turned we were talking last session of probably turning them over a little faster to the private sector in hopes that we would get those collections up early on. And there's been some discussion with revenue about that particular strategy.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on the collections measurement criteria, maybe explain to me, is that the, are we measuring, for example, 64%, is that the percentage of what the payment schedule that's been allocated for that year? So if there's a fine, if somebody was fined $3,500, but they were given a schedule over a period of 3 years to pay that, can you explain to me how what exactly we are measuring?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, yes. Exactly what we're measuring is the total amount of monies that have ever been collected going back to 1987 divided by the total amount of monies that have been imposed since 1987. This is a true percent of collection monies, and it goes back 20 years. The reason for that is that on any monetary judgment, it has a life cycle of 20 years by statute. In fact, in I believe it was January 1, 2006, the legislature enacted legislation that then took any criminal offense that has victim restitution forward to a 50-year life cycle. So this is literally the total amount of monies that were ever collected divided by the amount of monies ever imposed.
Oh, so it'd be very difficult to ever get to 100% within an annual cycle then, because we're going to be assessing fines that won't this year that won't be collected until out in the future.
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, that's exactly right. Part of the reason why we carry this for so long on the measurement is that with such a high percent of felons with outstanding receivables, they do tend to serve substantial periods of time in the prison and the jail systems. So what we try to do is we try to keep those options open and every avenue possible to make the collections when they're released, when they get out on probation parole, as well as when they actually become employable. Secondly, should they ever come into an inheritance or property or whatever, we're able to have liens against real property.
Thank you. And Mr. Adams, it seems that, correct me if I'm wrong or if anybody else would like to touch base about this, but that judges have a fair amount of discretion in how fines are levied. I mean, if they determine that an offender is never going to be able to pay this particular pie in the sky fine, that they could bring that down in many instances. Is that correct?
Chair Shields, that is correct. However, the vast majority of our outstanding receivables are restitution, whether it be restitution for attorney fees or victim restitution. The general inclination, at least I can only speak for my bench, is they impose whatever is owed a victim, they generally tend to impose that, as well as they always try to impose a full amount for court-appointed counsel at the public's expense.
Chair Shields, if I could just add real briefly, the legislature does have significant control over the extent to which courts have discretion regarding changing the amounts of certain fines and assessments. And by statute, this body has made certain types of fines and fees more inherently recoverable without discretion to reduce them than others. And so when the courts review these matters, the first thing they do is look to the language of the statute to see what, if any, discretion the legislature has provided in that circumstance.
And then in statute, we also prioritize that this has to be paid first before that. And I guess part of what I'm getting at is we often talk about how funding of one area affects funding of another. And what I've found in working with a lot of irresponsible probationers and parolees and addicts is that, you know, the effect of going through treatment helps them become more responsible people, and so that they end up, you know, before they would just complain about their fines and how they couldn't pay them, and then eventually they come to the point and they say, well, you know, rather than running from the judge, maybe I should go talk to the judge and see if I can work out a deal that might be better, and they end up paying their fines and paying child support, and a lot of cognitive behavioral therapies help in that regard as well. All right. Yes.
We passed a bill out of the Senate floor this morning that on interest, not start the interest on fines or whatever the judgments were until after they got out of prison. I sort of struggled with that because I wasn't quite sure. Do you guys have any thoughts on that, or did you see anything where if you didn't start the interest until after they got out of incarceration, that they're better able to pay it or something like that? I was really kind of at a loss at that bill this morning.
You want to comment?
Well, Chair Shields and Senator Nelson, I think that is a serious challenge for you to face, and it's ultimately a policy matter. What I can tell you from experience 6 years as a trial judge before coming to the Court of Appeals is some offenders are much more likely to take on an obligation and to pay it down if they see it as being ultimately manageable. And sometimes if the fine or the assessment is so overwhelming that it's hard to know where to get a start, we have seen less success in getting collections on that. I think Jim can respond to, you know, how the collections go, but as a trial judge who often acted as my own probation officer, where there was probation to the court, what I found is if I worked out a workable plan with an amount that realistically could be paid over time if, as the chair indicated, we were dealing with someone who truly was motivated to perform, we had much better success in collecting than starting with a huge mountain that nobody could ever get at. Jim, I don't know whether you wanted to add to that.
No, I couldn't add anything.
Mr.
Senator Winters.
Question. Do you have separated traffic fines from the other restitution and victim fines and those, because there is a difference in what are the collection numbers when we're talking traffic fines versus some of the other fines and penalties?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, in the data that I presented to you, the total amount collected divided by the total amount imposed actually does include all traffic as well.
But is there a way of separating them out where you get only the traffic totals?
Representative Shields, Senator Winters, I think that our collections people have been working on that, and what I can do is I can get a note and get back to you with that answer of what we have.
That would be good, because so that the data is not skewed, because you have different categories. And going after traffic citations and traffic tickets is and collecting those, I think, is a different challenge than if we're talking about some of the other restitution issues where you have somebody incarcerated in their term. So it would be good if we could have that data, if you can do it, separated.
Yeah, and if you get that to the professional staff, we'd appreciate that. Senator Nelson, did you have a question? Ms. Contini?
I believe we're on page 54, performance measure number 4, which is a representative workforce. We measure that by the percent of OJD people of color compared to the Oregon civilian workforce. In the efforts of time, I just simply want to say we have a lot of work to do on this. We have two different court improvement projects underway to try to increase our performance, because in 2007 we only had 68% of people color, and this is the only measure that I allowed to have 100% measure. Whenever you have 100%, you're never going to be able to achieve it. In this case, we felt so strongly about having a representative workforce, we established the 100% figure, but we clearly have quite a bit of work to do. In the ensuing biennium, we respectfully just request no change in either the actual measure or the target or goal. And we will report back to you in 2009 in terms of our findings on these two different projects.
Can I ask you a question about that? If somebody is trying to work in one form or fashion for OJD, would a criminal record prohibit them from being employed?
Chair Shields,
I don't know if that's a proper question for you, since you're just...
Well, I can take a shot at it as an administrative authority, hiring authority. Typically, we'll run a criminal record check, and what we're looking for is for when I'm hiring within the accounting division, and we're specifically looking for someone who has a record of fraud or embezzlement. But that, I believe, is the only time we take a look at the criminal record, per se, of an applicant.
What are the Mr.
Senator Winters?
What are the challenges? What are the challenges to reaching your goal?
Representative Shields, Chair Shields, and Senator Winters. Candidly, we don't know. Right now, we're attacking this at two fronts. The first is that we have a four-county pilot project that is actually attached a survey, a voluntary survey we're asking applicants to complete when they turn in an application. That information is pulled and sent on to the state court administrator's office. And what we're trying to do is to have a clear understanding of where our applicant pools are coming from. If our applicant pools have sufficient representation, then we most probably have a problem with our screening process, and we're going to have to very closely examine the hiring practices to make sure that we don't have any unintended bias built into the system. Secondly, we have a advisory group that's actually actively working on expanding our recruitment areas and pools to reach out and have better representation. But right now, it's in a preliminary state, and we're bringing that information in and trying to assess the data as it becomes available.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is the first time I've seen this.
Isn't there a circuit court in 33 counties? Is that right?
Well, there's 36 counties with 27 circuit courts.
27. Okay, I thought it was 26. But okay. It strikes me that maybe your number doesn't work here, because if you are trying to get a 15% of your labor force to match that requirement, and yet you have circuit courts and counties where you have, you know, less than 2% rather than the Oregon workforce, wouldn't you have to have a huge overrepresentation in those markets where you did have the availability to draw the folks you're looking for?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, yes, you're right, but what we're trying to do is within each community, each circuit court, have a representative workforce within that community, and that when it's distributed statewide, we hope to have a representative workforce that balances out to the statewide averages for people of color as well.
Follow up? But you just see my point there, where you go to a county where you don't have that workforce available, you might be trying to meet a goal. You're right. Kind of knocking your head on the wall.
this is a composite goal.
Okay. And one person could throw, could skew it pretty effectively for St. Gilliam County, where they only have a small.
But I do want to state very clearly, we have a lot of work to do on this issue.
Can I ask you a question about that? So in Multnomah County, the circuit court, the hiring for the circuit court is OJD. It's not Multnomah County.
Steal your pen.
Yes, Chair Shields. And all circuit courts are part of a statewide court system within the Judicial Department.
Please continue.
On page 55, you'll find performance measure number 5. Which is a trained workforce. Again, I think it's the committee feels that it's imperative that we quickly orient new employees to ensure their productivity and as well as efficiency and maximize public service. For the sake of time, our measure is a relatively new one. It was created with the 2005 legislature. Our performance has been 96% in 2005 and 6. Although we've only had one new educational program, we actually had 100% of our participants scored a minimum of four or on a scale of 5 as in terms of achieving new information and relevant information. We make no recommendation to change the actual measure itself per se, but we would like to increase the actual target to 90%. Also, we plan on making some slight changes in this measure in 2007-09. Specifically, we're going to do pre- and post-testing so we can measure how much information they had coming in, how much information they had coming out, to better assess the quality of our training programs and how we're setting up our new employees to go out into the workforce.
Just Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is going to sound pretty detailed. It's quibbling over a word here and there, but the way the measure is stated, it wasn't clear to me whether it's measuring how many people attended the programs or how many people said they learned something new they didn't already know because of attending the program. That makes sense?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, very much makes sense, and most probably confusion lies in the language. Prior to 2005, we did measure the number of participants that attended orientation programs within a timely manner. That measure was changed in 2005 to actually measure the information that they gained. And I think that might answer the confusion.
That's it.
And again, it takes a minimum score of 4 on a scale of 5 in order to be considered successful.
Thank you.
Of course. Performance measure 6. Is the timely case processing. This is a composite of the percent of cases that meet Oregon timely standards for disposition. It was modified in the 2005 session to include both juvenile dependency. Dependency is child abuse and neglect cases that come through the juvenile court, and we added two additional measures in 2005. The measures were around dependency are the time to jurisdiction, 60 days, and the time to our first permanency hearing. We've made gains over the years. From 2003, we went from 70% compliance to 2006, 77% compliance. We would like to leave this goal, this measure in place, the way it's written, but modify, increase the target to 78%. As much as we would like to make larger gains, and I acknowledge that's kind of a small gain to be trying to measure, this really is we have room to make improvements. We're doing a number of pilot projects throughout courts in terms of case flow management. This also, too, is a workflow issue, workload issue, in terms of the capacity for staff, the capacity for judges, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more in the following days about policy option packages to better address that particular measure.
Mr. Evans, can I ask you a question about that? Maybe you touched on this and I didn't catch it, but the Oregon Standards of Timely Disposition, is that a document that we might review that says for this kind of case, this is what timely disposition means?
Chair Shields, we would be pleased to provide you and the committee as well as staff a copy of that document. Yes, each major case type within Oregon has goals for timely dispositions at various stages or lives of the case. In this particular measure, we measure how it's a composite of how many we have goals for how many, what in what period of time we want 90% of the cases cleared, and in what period of time we hope to have 100% of our cases cleared. And it's by case type and category, and we'll be pleased to provide the committee that information.
How big is the document?
It's nominal. I believe we could consolidate it to one page for you.
That would be great if we could get that to Robin and distribute it. And the reason I'm interested is because, you know, what the literature shows is that it's not so much the length of the sentence for a lot of offenders, but it's the swiftness and the surety that they will be punished for an offense. And I think that, as you know, a lot of us plan on staying with Ways and Means over time, and to the degree that we can start to frame the judicial budget in ways that we could shrink that, I think that would be something that the committee would be interested in the interests of enhancing public safety.
I can only echo that. That's very wise. I think it was Sir William Gladstone in the 1800s coined the phrase that justice delayed is justice denied. The quality of justice is directly proportionate to the ability to timely address and dispose of cases. Secondly, as in any private business, it costs money to warehouse product. And just because a case is quote-unquote inactive and sits on a court shelf, I can most assure you it costs us money. And so it's incumbent on us, both in terms of a qualitative as well as an economic standard, to do a good job on clearing our caseloads in a timely manner.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I ask a question about Performance Measure 7? I'm not understanding the length in the first bullet point, the intergovernmental plans. I assume that means permanent foster care, guardianship, or adoption. And I guess I'm curious as to what the time frame is, because obviously if there's no time frame, I guess what I would encourage is a really short time frame and 100%. We should be at 100%. So, let's ask the chair. Madam Chair.
Senator Brown, Performance Measure 7, if we're ready to move on, in 2005 was basically a placeholder. And what I'm going to recommend to this committee is to allow us to continue to have a placeholder. In 2005, what we measured was the percent of circuit courts that simply had intergovernmental plans that supported permanency outcomes for children in foster care. The State Court Administrator's Office did a wonderful job on facilitating local communities coming together and creating plans that improved outcomes for our foster care system, our dependent care system. In 2007, what we're asking is, now that the vast majority of communities have those plans, is to have us struggle with coming up with local performance measures that we will support. The reason for this is this is really complex stuff when it comes to child welfare and child safety. We're not this is what Senator Schrader would coin the phrase a systems measure. We're coming together with the juvenile court, Department of Human Services with Child Welfare Protection, the Attorney General's Office with our District Attorney's Office, alcohol drug treatment providers, and many more people have to come to the table on this. I'm not aware nationally of anyone who's tackled this measure because of its complexity, but I am here in great confidence that in 2009 we'll report back to you on a universal first-time measure for this. Because, again, of the five goals of the Justice 2020 strategic plan, building strong community partnerships is one of those goals. And the committee, the PMAC, couldn't think of a stronger measure than this to test those partnerships.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then I'm not understanding what the goal is here, because I assume by intergovernmental, I assume you mean not a return home to parent, right?
No. This is Chair Shields, Representative Brown. This measure, an intergovernmental plan, is a plan within a local community on how they're going to process dependency cases.
Okay. All right. So it's bigger than
it's cases. Much,
okay.
It's much
all right.
Bigger.
All right. Okay.
It's a very detailed, comprehensive plan bringing all those agencies together.
Okay.
Senator Winters.
Along that line, your work with the Commission on Children, Families, and others become extremely critical and valuable in the various counties and communities.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, absolutely. Same thing with CASAs. They're absolutely integral to our success.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
I'm sorry.
So
what is the information we're trying to achieve by developing this? That's what I'm not understanding, I guess.
Chair Shields and Representative Brown, the reason I think you're struggling with this is because this what's being presented to you right now is not an outcome measure. It's an output. It's just a count.
Okay. Right.
To us, an output is a count. An outcome is like a lofty goal, a desired outcome. And this is like a placeholder trying to help us work through the complex nature of child welfare, Senator Brown, to get us to the point where we have a common plan within each community, and from there we can try to bring all these entities together to create and support a common single outcome-based measure that we'll present to you in 2009. We just simply have more work to do.
Mr. Chair, along that line, I think that because we have public safety here and you're part of that, but human services and the department also should have, you know, even though as a part of their outcome, because they're dealing with dependency, foster care, and some of the components, as well as the Commission on Children and Families, because it isn't just one single entity. You're talking about bringing the community together in order to plan for children, particularly those that are in foster care.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, you're exactly right. Our community had more than 20 different agency participants engaged in the planning process to come up with our intergovernmental plan in Jackson County. That's common in other communities.
Okay, we've got three more to go. Let's try to get through by 4:30 if at all possible.
Performance measure 8 is drug court recidivism. This falls within the building strong community partnerships and promoting public safety and quality of life. Again, another example of a systems measure. And what it measures is the percent of adult drug court graduates with no misdemeanor or felony charges 12 months after graduation from our drug courts. Drug courts are simply the best evidence-based program for working with people who have addiction issues. 77% of our drug court people have histories of methamphetamine use. From 2003, we've improved our outcomes on this from 89% to 93%. The national average is 84% for that same period of time. And the last point I'll leave with you is that we're actually trying to measure how durable is this, are these programs. And a number of our courts now have enough experience that 3 years after graduation, we're still having 83% of our graduates, drug court graduates, have no recidivism within 3 years post-graduation. There is no national measure that I'm aware of that goes out 3 years. There is one that goes out 2 years, and it's only 72%. So what
could you repeat that for me, the 3 years?
In Oregon, 3 years post-drug court graduation, 83% of our graduates will not have any new felony or misdemeanor charges filed in the state of Oregon. Nationally, there is no 3-year standard, but there is a 2-year measure, and only 72% nationally can meet that standard. Simply put, I think what I surmise from this information is that Oregon's drug court programs work, they're durable, and they statistically significantly exceed national standards. We ask for no change in either the measure or the standard in this case.
Do we have a sense of what percentage graduate?
I don't have that information with me, but someone from staff can get that to you.
That would be good. Thanks. If you can get that to Robin and distribute it.
If it is helpful, I can tell you we just started a drug court up. It's been running a little more than a year. And we have 96 people the last time I looked at the data And during the course of the year, we've terminated 16 participants, if that gives you a feel, at least in my court. Now, that may be not representative. Performance measure 9 is juror satisfaction. In 2005, we came to you and asked you to authorize us to measure the percent of jurors that are satisfied with their jury experience, requiring a minimum score of 3 out of 4 on a survey we run twice a year in Oregon trial courts. Jurors are the heart of what we do. We're an unusual branch of government in the context of the jurors, the public, are the decision makers in our cases. I was asking Judge Brewer before the hearing started, how rare is it, how usual is it that a case can be overturned at the appellate level based on a juror's actions? It's very rare. Their word is sacred in the court system. We had almost 200,000 jury service days in 2006. I'm pleased to say that we had positive scores on 94% both in 2006 and 2007. We asked that this questionnaire and this measure remain the same. It's predicated on the DOS customer service essential elements. The only change we respectfully request from you is to challenge us more. Obviously, 85, we undershot it. We need to be at least in the 95 percentile range on this.
And I remember Judge Robinson, rest his soul, used to write letters to all jurors thanking them for his service, which I thought was an incredible, nice touch. Do we have any sense of what percentages minorities participate in juries? Is that a number that you could get to us?
Chair Shields, I'm unaware of any measurement for that, but I will ask staff to check into it and get back to you one way or the other on that.
And real quick, and then I'll let you go on that. I remember a while back there was a bill in this body that would have changed jury selection to make it by driver's license. Did that fail or did that pass? It was years ago. Does anybody remember? If you could look into that.
Chair Shields, currently it's a composite of, it merges both Oregon driver's license and registered voters.
And that's by statute or by rule that's decided?
It is by statute. Sorry for the delayed response.
Sorry to delay.
Sure, Shields, these are great questions. I enjoy this process.
Occasionally I get lucky.
Well, we learn a lot. Performance measure 10, last but not least, is quality self-represented services, or what we also call facilitation, our self-help centers for people who are going through dissolution, child custody kinds of cases. During the 2005 Public Safety Ways and Means hearings, we reported to the legislature that it was our intent to come back to you with an actual outcome-based measure. The reason it's so relevant and important to us is that statewide, approximately 70% of dissolution cases, one or both parties, are unrepresented, and that it's imperative to have good outcomes because children raised in poverty don't have good outcomes. And so PMAC has worked with the State Family Law Advisory Committee and has come up with a number of essential or key elements to what constitutes quality facilitation services, and we're prepared to actually begin implementing a customer satisfaction survey in 2007, again predicated and built upon the good work of the Department of Administrative Services. If that meets with your approval, and we would suggest an initial target setting of 75. We've never even run this instrument. It's still a work in progress, so I have no idea if that's high or low, candidly.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, my experience, and we've talked about this a little bit earlier, is that a lot of the folks that need this aren't able to access it, so it would also be very useful for us if you're looking at expanding the program at some point in the future for us to get a sense of how many people need it, aren't getting it. And it's great if the one person out of 20 is happy with the services, but if there are 19 others that don't get it, that's certainly an issue that we should know about.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, you're exactly right in your analysis, and part of what took us as long as it did to create this instrument is is that we have questions that we believe get right to those answers. That concludes the trial court performance measures. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Judge Brewer, and then if there's time, I'm happy to do wrap-up thoughts. If not, we can just conclude at the end of his statements.
And Chair Shields, if the committee needs to adjourn, we want to be really respectful of your time. And why don't you tell us where you are?
We do have to be on the floor at 4:30.
So. Okay, and so it's at 4:30 now.
Oh, that clock's slow. Sorry about that.
You need to leave now.
We can wrap up for a minute.
All right. Well, let me just tell you this. If you take a look at page 61 of the materials, and you can do this later, what you see are four measures that the Court of Appeals has tentatively adopted internally as appellate court performance measures. As I indicated at the outset, we believe we're the first appellate court in the nation to explore adopting these. We've already implemented a pilot project quality survey among the appellate lawyers and trial courts, who are the consumers of our services, that we expect to get some results on here shortly, and we intend to publish those results regardless of what they are and use that just as a stepping stone for future quality improvement. We found that surveys are probably the best tool in that regard. The other measures relate to efficiency and productivity, and those are things that we are deeply concerned about in shepherding our resources. So we're glad to answer any questions you have about those measures as works in progress, either now or as time passes, and we really very much appreciate the opportunity to present before you today, and thank you for your time and attention.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Adams, Ms. McKenzie. This is a great job. Any other questions? All right, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.